I've always been fascinated with the extremes of human population patterns, both the parts of the world that are unusually empty and the parts of the world that are unusually crowded. And I recently came across what might just be the most interesting and most unusually crowded location in the entire world. This tiny little island in the middle of the Indian Ocean that's known as Male, which is probably the most densely populated island in the world today, and maybe the most densely populated island ever seen in history. You see, Male is the capital city of the Maldives, an archipelagic state in the Indian Ocean that's located hundreds of kilometers away from the Asian mainland in India. There are no less than 1,196 separate and distinct islands that are located within the Maldives, but all of them are very small. The largest of all of these nearly 1,200 islands is no larger than 4 square kilometers, and they're all stretched out across a vast distance that spans for about 871 kilometers north to south. Despite encompassing an area that makes up around 90,000 square kilometers in total, more than 99% of the Maldives territory is open ocean, and only a tiny 298 square kilometers of that total area is actually land, making the Maldives one of the smallest countries in the world in terms of available land. With a current population of about 528,000 people today, this makes the Maldives the fifth most densely populated country in the world today, largely only behind city-states like Monaco, Singapore, and Vatican City. But in truth, the Maldives are way more densely populated than even this list implies. Because despite having nearly 1,200 islands and 298 square kilometers worth of available land to choose from to live on, nearly half of the entire country's population lives on just 2 next-door islands that only make up around 6 square kilometers. The city of Male itself, administratively speaking, encompasses 7 separate, nearby small islands near the archipelago's center, though only 4 of them are significant from a geographic size or population standpoint. The total population of the whole city today is around 263,000 people, nearly half the total population of the Maldives. But only 3 of these islands within the city are really inhabited by all of these people. There's Vilangili, the smallest inhabited island in the city, which is home to around 7,000 people. Then there's the artificially made Holhumale Island, which has been under construction since 1997 and is currently home to around 66,000 other people, and is about 4 square kilometers in size, which would already make it one of the most densely populated islands in the world, with a similar scale of density as Hong Kong Island is currently in China. But Holhumale's already impressive density in the middle of the ocean is eclipsed by the even more catastrophic density that's going on right next door on the island of Male itself, from which the greater city of Male takes its overall name from. At a mere 1.95 square kilometers in total area, the tiny island of Male is the core of Male, the city, and of the Maldives as a whole. The very name of the Maldives, translated literally from the native Devehi language of the islands, means the islands or dives of Male, implying that all of the other islands in the country are ruled directly from the center of power in Male. As of 2024, based on the Maldives' most recent census numbers from 2022 and the United Nations population estimates for 2024, it's believed that there are currently around a whopping 190,000 people who live together crowded on this tiny little island, roughly 36% of the Maldives' entire population, and which makes this little island in the middle of the Indian Ocean not only among the most densely populated islands in the world, but one of the most densely populated places in the world today, period. Male's population density today is about 97,436 people per square kilometer, which makes it more than 3 times as densely populated of an island as Manhattan is in New York City. Wikipedia maintains an extensive list of islands by population density, but from the research that I put into this list for this video, it appears that this Wikipedia list is still using outdated census data for Malay's population from the year 2006, which at this point is nearly 20 years outdated. Plenty of other islands on this list have been updated with much more recent data from the 2020s. So, if we take the current UN population estimate for Male Island and update it on this list along with all of the other islands, Male's true rank on the list should actually put it very firmly in third place worldwide by overall density, behind only 2 other very small islands in Haiti that have very tiny populations numbering only in the few hundred, compared to Male's nearly 200,000 people, an order of magnitude greater scale. So besides for these two little Haitian islands that have fewer than 1,000 people between both of them, Male is truly the most densely populated island in the world today. And it certainly looks like it when you view it through Google Maps. My goodness. No amount of space was wasted on the island. The concrete coverage of it quite literally stretches out from the center of the island to the very edge of the sea. Soaring skyscrapers fill up the limited space of the island, within a country where no natural point stretches more than 5 meters above sea level. Crowded streets below are full of people, cars, and motorbikes everywhere. The sound of constant traffic making you feel as if you were in a blender. The very limited housing and space means that multiple generations all living together in a single room is the norm here. The city looks like something that was pulled directly out of SimCity in a real life. Or if you're a cultured individual, it looks like a real-life version of a one-tile island megacity that you'd build in one of the Sid Meier Civilization games. In fact, Male is so small that it's a fraction of the size of several open-world RPG games. It is a minuscule fraction the size of the map in Grand Theft Auto V, for example. And it's more similar to the map size found in the now ancient Grand Theft Auto Vice City. The island of Male itself is less than 2 kilometers wide at its absolute widest point. It's possible to walk across the entire island east to west in only about 20 minutes, while it's also possible to completely circumnavigate the entire island on foot in only about 90 minutes. It is a very, very small space for 190,000 people to all live contained in. On Wikipedia's other list of the most densely populated cities in the world, Male already appears in 5th place. Though this list factors in the total number of islands that are within the city, some of which are uninhabited, and which also uses the population figure of the city acquired from the 2022 Maldives census, rather than the UN's 2024 estimate that I'm using. So if instead you plugged in the UN's 2024 population estimate for Male, it would suddenly jump up into being the 3rd most densely populated city in the world. And if you considered only the little island of Male itself with its 190,000 people, it would be by far the number 1 most densely populated city in the world, with more than double the density that's seen in Manila, Giza, and Croix-de-Bouquet. And what makes Male's insane level of density all the more bizarre is that it's also basically in the middle of nowhere. A mini Manhattan more than 3 times denser than the real Manhattan, surrounded by hundreds of kilometers of absolute nothingness in every direction. In sharp contrast to the other super dense cities on Wikipedia's list like Giza and Croix-de-Bouquet, which are really just parts of the greater Cairo and Port-au-Prince metropolitan areas that are very close by to other huge population centers. The island of Male is insanely interesting to me, not just because it's arguably the most densely populated island and the most densely populated city in the world today, but also because it's basically all a speck of incredible, record-shattering density that's all in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It is roughly 605 kilometers from the city of Male to the nearest continental mainland in India, with the nearest other settlement of similar size, which also makes Male among the most remote and isolated cities of its size anywhere in the world. To really hit home here how absurd the population situation really is on Male, consider the Big Island in Hawaii. This island is huge at 10,430 square kilometers in area, making it roughly the same size as Lebanon or Kosovo. The Big Island is a whopping 5,349 times bigger than the tiny little island of Male is, and yet their populations are roughly equivalent. With around 200,000 people who live spread out across the Big Island and around 190,000 people who are concentrated together on Male, which to me is totally mind-blowing. And what's even more, Malay's insanely high density is only a very recent phenomenon, and it's still continuing to get even denser with time too. As recently as 1967, Malay's city population was only recorded as being 11,453 people, only about a tenth of its population a day, while it also only made up about one-tenth of the Maldives' total population, rather than the half of the country's population it makes up today. In only a little more than half a century since that time, Malay's population exploded by nearly tenfold into becoming arguably the most densely populated island and city in the world. The Maldives became vastly more centralized around the island city. An entire brand new small island with tens of thousands of people right next door to Malé, called Hulhu Malé, appeared out of nowhere, and within the next half century, it all might be destroyed and buried beneath the sea. Its fleeting, fascinating existence potentially all just a bizarre abnormality of our current time. So how did this whole situation on Malé happen so quickly? What is life on the world's most crowded island like today, and where is it all going to go in the future? Tens of millions of years ago, the Indian tectonic plate gradually drifted to the north before smashing into Asia. The Himalayan mountain chain is the most famous geographic feature that was created by the Indian plate's movement. But before it hit Asia and formed those mountains, it also tore through the Earth's crust and created a ridge of volcanic peaks across the Indian Ocean. Over the eons of time that followed, the peaks of those volcanoes gradually eroded away, which formed the coral-encrusted atolls of the Maldives that we know today. Each one made up of a relatively small ring of exposed coral that narrowly poke out from beneath the sea's surface. The very word atoll that we use in English to describe this geographic formation is directly taken from the native language of the Maldives, Divehi. Geographically, the Maldivian archipelago consists of 1,196 of these such atolls, all of which are naturally small and no larger than 2.5 square kilometers, and 80% of which rise no more than 1 meter above sea level. Humans from the Indian subcontinent likely first discovered the Maldives and began settling in them fairly recently, around 2,500 years ago, while documented first contact with the outside world began around the year 947 AD, when Arab merchants first began to visit them. In the year 1153, the Islamic faith was introduced to the Maldives, and the archipelago was shortly fully consolidated as a sultanate. It was during this period that the island of Malé became the central island of authority for the Maldivian sultans, where they constructed their palaces and their mosques, and from where they exercised authority across their vast maritime domain of scattered atolls. Nonetheless, Malé remained a relatively small and generally insignificant settlement for nearly all of its history. European influence in the archipelago began increasing during the European Age of Discovery, and the Maldives eventually fell into becoming a protectorate of the British Empire by 1887, at which point the city of Malé was recorded as only having a population of just 2,148 inhabitants. Generations later, the Maldives eventually achieved their independence from Britain in 1965. And then a couple years later, in 1967, during the first census that was recorded by the independent Maldives, Malé's population was recorded as still being very small compared to what it is today, at just 11,453 people within the city, about 23 times fewer people than live there today, while it also only made up about 1/10 of the Maldives' total population at the time, compared to the around half of the total population that it makes up today. Most of the rest of the Maldivian population back then in the late 1960s lived much as they had for the past millennia of their history, scattered around about 200 other inhabited island atolls that were found throughout the rest of the archipelago, often hundreds of kilometers away from the seat of power in Malé, and deeply impoverished and heavily reliant on fishing for their survival. However, radical events would soon be set in motion that would begin leading to Malé's meteoric rise in population and density that we know today. Because in 1972, the very first tourist resort opened up on one of the islands in the country, and that quickly began changing everything about the Maldives forever. Prior to this, the Maldives were rarely ever visited from abroad and were almost totally unknown to the global tourism industry. But the president of the Maldives at the time, Ibrahim Nasir, understood well the untapped potential for international tourism that he believed his country possessed. Nearly 1,000 uninhabited and spectacularly beautiful islands with fabulous weather that were just waiting to be developed into luxurious private island resorts for wealthy global travelers. President Nasir saw tourism as a means to diversify and modernize the country's economy, and a successor to the presidency in the Maldives understood the power of tourism even more. During his long 30-year rule in the Maldives as president between 1978 and 2008, Gayoom oversaw the radical transformation of the Maldives' economy from a poor, fishing-based economy to a middle-income, tourism-based economy. One of the most unique hospitality laws that the Maldives adopted during this time period was that each island destined to become a resort island would be fully reserved for just one single resort, meaning that each resort that opened up in the Maldives would have their own complete private island dedicated fully to the resort. offering a unique sense of private luxury tourism to the resorts away from the rest of civilization. And with nearly 1,000 uninhabited islands in the Maldives that were generating zero economic value before this, the country had almost no shortage of islands to offer up to major resort and hospitality companies from all around the world to develop into their own luxurious private island retreats. During Gayoom's 30-year presidency, he oversaw the development of around 90 previously uninhabited islands in the Maldives into ultra-luxurious paradises for the world's wealthiest people. Today, there are no less than 170 of these so-called resort islands that can be found all across the Maldives, and there are several dozen more that are already being actively developed. 170-plus private resort islands that are completely dedicated to international tourism, and that are all individually administered by just a single resort per island. When you scroll around the Maldives in Google Maps today, you'll see this pretty clearly. There are dozens and dozens of islands here with private resorts almost everywhere you scroll. Many of the most well-known luxury hospitality brands in the world now operate their own private island resorts in the Maldives. And many of them have become among the most desirable vacation destinations anywhere in the world, that have been even more popularized recently by the likes of Instagram, such as the Ritz-Carlton, the St. Regis, the Four Seasons, the Cheval Blanc, the Raffles, the Waldorf Astoria, and perhaps the most popular Maldivian resort of all on Instagram, the Soniva Jani, with its picture-perfect white sand beaches, crystal-clear blue waters, and spectacular wooden bungalows with private pools hanging over it all in complete privacy, where guests spending more than $3,000 a night for one bedroom is pretty routine. Despite being governed as an Islamic republic that practices a strict interpretation of Islamic Sharia law, the country's religious laws were almost completely abandoned on the resort islands in order to make them more appealing to non-Muslim foreign tourists. So while drinking alcohol or women wearing bikinis is forbidden in the capital city of Malay, they were allowed freely by the government on the resort islands. And beyond the strict practicing of Islamic religious law, not that many tourists were ever visiting the crowded, congested capital city of Malay anyway. The overwhelming appeal of tourism to the Maldives in the modern era have always been the beautiful, luxurious, and pristine private island resorts. So virtually all foreign tourists who arrive in the Maldives arrive first at the country's primary international airport on the island of Hulhule, that's directly adjacent to the island of Malay, which up until the 1990s was basically just a humble airstrip that had no permanent residents, whose sole purpose was to shuttle tourists back and forth between the outside world and the resort islands, using what has been for a long time now the largest seaplane operation that the world has ever known. As tourism to the Maldives began skyrocketing with the development and the promotion of these spectacularly beautiful, high-end private island resorts, the country's economy began booming as well. The country's tourism industry led the country's GDP per capita to skyrocket by a whopping 265% just across the 1980s, and then by another 115% more across the 1990s. Since tourism was introduced to the Maldives with the opening of the first resort in 1972, the country's GDP per capita in current US dollars has increased by an astonishing 65-fold. While the numbers of tourists visiting the country have almost continually increased with every passing year. Across 2024, an all-time high number of 2,046,615 international tourists came to visit the Maldives, about four times more than the actual resident population of the country, and they collectively brought in $5.6 billion in revenue for the country, 84% of which all came from the country's numerous private island resorts. Tourism has since become such a dominant industry in the Maldives that it now accounts for 28% of the country's entire GDP, more than 60% of the country's foreign exchange receipts, and a whopping 90% of the government's total tax revenue. And thus, the Maldives transitioned into sort of the poster child for the tourist state, a country extremely reliant on the tourism industry in the same way that petrostates became extremely reliant on the oil and gas industry. Based on the World Travel and Tourism Council's 2019 list of countries by over-reliance on tourism, the Maldives came in at fourth place globally behind only three other small island states in the Caribbean. The list estimated that an astonishing 60% of all the jobs in the Maldives by that point were reliant on the tourism industry. In a way, the Maldives began increasingly functioning like a petrostate does, with a centralized city in Malé controlling a sprawling empire of distant, money-generating offshore tourism resorts that economically function similarly to offshore oil rigs controlled by petrostates. Very soon after the tourism boom took off, three different versions of the Maldives arose. The traditional island lifestyles across nearly 200 inhabited islands in the archipelago. The increasing numbers of resort islands that were entirely made up of workers and tourists and no locals, and the growing megacity, at least by Maldivian standards, in Malé. Because as the money spigot from the tourism industry continued gushing into the country, the Maldivian government chose to sink the overwhelming majority of the windfalls into developing the capital city and the seat of government and power around Malé. And as a result, Malé became an increasingly desirable place to live for the hundreds of thousands of Maldivians that were out in the outer islands, which were and still are some of the most remote and underdeveloped villages anywhere on the planet. Malé became the epicenter of opportunity in the new, modern economy of the Maldives that the tourism industry had introduced to the country. Malé was always the seat of the country's government, but after tourism and all the money it brought in, it also became the center of the country's tourism industry as the connection point between the international airport and all of the resort islands. The government's decision to spend most of the tourism revenue on further developing Malé meant that soon the best schools and the best hospitals in the country were all located there as well. With the best access to education and healthcare in the country, and the best top-paying jobs in government bureaucracy and tourism, Maldivians in the outer islands began increasingly leaving them behind in search of better opportunities for themselves and their families in the capital. The outer inhabited islands languished hundreds of kilometers away from the increasingly developing capital, and they were also far removed from the tourism-centric resort islands, as the resorts and the gobs of money they were generating were only being constructed on the uninhabited islands in order to maximize their sense of private luxury to the tourists. And at the same time, the traditional fishing industry that had dominated Maldivian society for thousands of years across these outer islands began growing harder and harder to make a decent living through in the modern era, due to rampant illegal foreign overfishing in Maldivian waters that began greatly diminishing the Maldives' fish stocks. Maldivian fishermen on the outer islands were being increasingly forced to travel further and further out into the ocean to try and find their fish. Fishing increasingly became a hard and unrewarding profession. The new tourism industry burgeoning at the resorts and in the capital offered them much easier work for much higher pay. And thus, Maldivian fishermen increasingly left behind their traditions and were recruited by the new tourism industry to become divers or to help out with transportation instead. And so, there eventually became a sort of tipping point where most of the Maldivians in the outer islands began leaving them to either work at the tourist resorts or to work in the capital in Malé. And so Malé began increasingly swelling in population with the new arrivals. Because of these developments, Malé's population nearly tripled in just a decade between the 1967 and 1977 censuses, after the tourism industry was first introduced in 1972, and the population in Malé started getting so high in the 1980s that they filled in what used to be the island's central lagoon in order to make more space for all of the crowds of newcomers that were relocating from the outer islands in search of work, education, healthcare, better living standards, and opportunity. There are not many photos I've been able to track down online that show this incredible transformation happening, but there are a few. These ones, for example, show the unbelievable differences in density in Malé between 1967, before the tourism industry was introduced, and in 2010, decades after the tourism industry was introduced, making them almost appear to not even be the same island. And then in the 1990s, a new driving force pushing Maldivians from the outer islands to the capital began quickly emerging too, the emerging clarity on the direction of global climate change and sea level rise. The Maldives are one of, if not the, most exposed countries in the world to climate change and rising sea levels. 80% of all the islands within the country are less than 1 meter above sea level, while the highest natural point in the entire country, on the small island of Vilangili within the capital city, is only 5.1 meters high. The Maldives actually has the lowest average elevation of every country in the world. with an average elevation above sea level across the country of just 1.5 meters, which also makes the country the most dangerously exposed to rising sea levels during the 21st century. Among the islands that rise no higher than 1 meter above sea level is the main island of Malay itself, which means that there's a very high probability that the capital island and more than 80% of the rest of the country could be completely submerged and destroyed just by the end of this century. The most recent models released by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change show two different potential future outcomes. Since the advent of the Industrial Revolution, the Earth's mean surface temperature has already increased by 1 degree Celsius. Over the next several decades, depending on how severely humanity is able to reduce their collective greenhouse gas emissions, the Earth's average surface temperature will likely rise to either 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial era. If the Earth's temperature rises to 1.5 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial times, sea levels will likely rise by between 0.26 and 0.77 meters from today. While if the Earth's temperature rises further to 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial times instead, sea levels will likely rise by between 0.36 and 0.87 meters, with other potential estimates going as high as 1 meter or even 2 meters above current values. That means that under the worst-case scenarios, with the global surface temperature rising to 2 degrees Celsius or more over pre-industrial times, almost all of the Maldives, including virtually all of the country's cash cow resort islands, and the super-densely populated capital island of Malay, home to around 190,000 people today, will all be underwater and will all need to be abandoned. To make matters even worse, more pressures pushing people out of the outer islands towards the capital began mounting after 2004, when the devastating Great Indian Ocean tsunami rocked the country. Within just an hour of the earthquake beginning just to the east of the Maldives, the tsunami arrived with almost no warning and inundated most of the country, including the capital. Around 100 people in the country lost their lives, and more than $500 million worth of economic destruction was caused, which was about half of the country's total GDP at the time. Many of the inhabited outer islands were virtually completely destroyed by the disaster and made uninhabitable, which greatly accelerated the trend of people from the outer islands moving towards the increasingly crowded capital in search of stability and safety. With the knowledge around the extent of future sea level rise becoming increasingly clear in the 1990s, the Maldivian government knew that it had to begin taking drastic action against this existential security threat. And so they began plowing the money they were earning from the increasingly lucrative tourism sector into one of the world's most significant geoengineering projects to try and save themselves. Fully aware that the tiny and insanely crowded island of Malay itself could never house hundreds of thousands of additional people in the future, in 1997, the Maldivian government decided to enlist the help of Dutch and Belgian dredging companies to begin a decades-long process to build a completely new island nearby to Malay that they called Holhumalay. Designed to be about 4 square kilometers in area and about 2 meters above sea level, Holhumalay was designed to be about twice the size of Malay and twice as high above the sea level in order to safeguard it past even the worst sea level predictions during the 21st century. Holhumalay was simultaneously designed to become the country's climate refuge for the future and to ease the overcrowding problem happening in Malay and to try and spur on further economic development. Also frequently referred to as the City of Hope, Holhumalay was to be built up from nothing in 2 separate phases and was to be the opposite experience from Malay, offering new residents more space, better urban design, and better livability from the hectic, haphazard chaos going on in Malay. Millions of tons of sand from the sea were dredged up to create the new island at great financial cost. Phase 1 focused on the development of the southern half of the new island and is currently scheduled to be fully completed next year in 2026. The first 1,000 new residents to Holhumalay moved in back in 2004, and by now the new island is home to about 66,000 people. Phase 2, focused on developing the northern half of the new island, is still an active work in progress, with great ambitions for the future. Dozens of soaring new multi-story apartment blocks have been constructed across the new island, and once Phase 2 is finished, by the current projections in 2035, the plan is to have enough housing and space on the island to accommodate 240,000 people on it. It's now widely expected that within only a decade, by the mid-2030s, up to 2/3 of the entire population of the Maldives will all live within the islands of the capital city, with around 200,000 people still living on Malay and around 240,000 or so more people living on nearby Holhumalay. If all of that comes to pass, then the Maldives will likely become home to not one, but two of the top 10 most densely populated islands in the world. And they'll both be right next to each other. Already, when you use Google Earth's history view, you can watch the astonishing speed at which Hulhu Mali was developed between 2001 and the present, from nothing into a city of tens of thousands, and likely soon to be hundreds of thousands. Each tower on Hulhu Mali contains what used to be an entire island's worth of people from the past, as the whole country's population pattern and culture has radically shifted very quickly from one of a spread-out seafaring people separated by hundreds of kilometers of ocean to one of extremely high centralization and urbanization, with more and more people concentrating in the capital that's connected to all of the resort islands. With already nearly half of the country's population all living within the confines of the capital city's small islands today, and with about two-thirds of the population that'll probably be living there by the mid-2030s, the Maldives will be the fifth most heavily centralized country in the world, behind only city-states like Vatican City, Monaco, and Singapore, and just behind Kuwait in fourth place. The Maldives will, increasingly with time, resemble something that economically looks a whole lot like Kuwait. In Kuwait's case, a densely populated city-state based around Kuwait City that controls money-generating oil fields in the sparsely populated deserts around it, and in the Maldives' case, a densely populated city-state based around Malay that controls money-generating tourist resorts in the sparsely populated ocean around it. One of the more bizarre things about the island of Malay itself is that despite it being so small you can walk across it in only 20 minutes and around it in only 90 minutes, and despite the weather being generally pretty great year-round, it is still absolutely saturated by personal vehicles and hardly anyone appears to walk very far. A report by the Maldivian government in 2023 found that a whopping 82% of the road space across the city of Malay was occupied by vehicles, which left only the remaining 18% of the road space available to pedestrians. An even higher ratio than in New York City, where just 75% of the road space is occupied by vehicles instead. The report also found that there were nearly 120,000 vehicles that were used on the roads within the city of Malay, 87% of which were motorcycles. It also found that on the island of Malay itself, the density of vehicles was an incredible 42,669 vehicles per square kilometer, more than four times the density of vehicles per square kilometer that is found in the city of Los Angeles, arguably America's most sprawling car-centric city. The report concluded that the chronic overuse of vehicles on Malay had reached unsustainable levels. But that is far from the only unsustainable facet of life here. Without any local energy resources beyond potentially solar power, all of the electricity in Malay is powered by massive diesel generators that approach the size of entire city blocks, and all of their fuel is imported from abroad. The entire city's water supply is provided through water desalination technology, while all of the city's sewage is pumped through pipes unprocessed out a couple hundred meters into the sea, where it sometimes just washes back up on the island's beaches. Garbage and trash produced in the city and in the resorts gets loaded up on barges and is transported to a nearby island to Malay called Thila Fushi, where up to 500 tons of garbage is dumped at per day, and where several hundred migrant workers work away without safety equipment to process through and burn it all, leading to the island being nicknamed Garbage Island. Surrounding the tiny beaches of Malay are a series of vast fortifications that are known as tetrapods, built to protect the main island from rising sea levels and storm surges, but a rather ugly sight to behold that ruins the appeal of the beaches. As a result, similar fortifications have been spared from being employed at the resort islands so as not to disturb their natural beauty. But as a consequence, the resort islands have also been left much more exposed and undefended to the future wrath of the sea. By this point, roughly one half of the entire Maldivian government's budget, which is overwhelmingly provided by the country's tourism industry, is being spent on climate change and sea level rise mitigation efforts, with most of the development still being concentrated around the capital in Malay. In 2018, the Maldives completed the construction of a 1.4-kilometer-long bridge that finally connected the crowded island of Malay with the airport island of Hulhule, which by proxy also connected the island of Malay with the brand-new, heavily populated island of Hulhu Mali, which enabled people to increasingly move out to Hulhu Mali and to commute from there into Malay for work, slightly easing the overpopulation problem going on in Malay itself. The bridge was the very first one to connect two of the Maldives islands together, and at a cost of $210 million, it didn't come cheap. And much of the financing for it came from the Chinese government, which is why the bridge was initially called the China-Maldives Friendship Bridge before it was later renamed. Currently under construction, the Maldives are also building out another inter-island bridge from Malay to Vilangili, home to another 7,000 or so people, and then another bridge from Vilangili to the island of Golhifalhu, which is currently undergoing a similar massive dredging and land reclamation project that Holhou Malay underwent before it. The Maldives' master plan is to eventually finish the land reclamation project in Golhifalhu and transform it into basically another Holhou Malay, another extension of Malay City that could one day also be home to hundreds of thousands of people. It is quite possible, however, that the Maldives is probably the most unsustainable society on the planet today in the 21st century. It is a country that is increasingly running out of just about everything. It is running out of space, it is running out of fresh water, and most critically, it is running out of time. The dual pressures that are continuing to fuel the population growth of Malay, already insanely overcrowded, are only accelerating in pace. The economic, education, and healthcare opportunities in the outer islands is continuing to be neglected, as the government invests everything in developing and safeguarding the capital and the cash-generating tourist resorts, which is leading to ever more people abandoning the outer islands for the capital, on top of the increasingly dire flooding issues which will affect the outer islands far more than the better-protected capital, leading to this continuous feedback loop where the outer islands continue depopulating while the capital continues growing. The Maldives is also aware that their lucrative tourism industry that's earning them a lot of cash right now will not last forever, since they cannot protect all of the tourist resorts with flood barriers and seawalls the same way that they're doing with the capital, since doing so would undermine their natural beauty and tourism appeal. It is likely that by the end of this century, most, if not all, of the country's outer islands and resort islands will be underwater and destroyed. And then, all that will be left of the Maldives will be an impossibly overcrowded chain of tiny nearby islands around the capital, covered by flood barriers still governed by strict Islamic Sharia law that I cannot imagine will be as popular of a place to visit. The booming tourism industry in the Maldives probably only has this century to remain lucrative, which is what's pushing the Maldives into a race against the clock to sink the money that they're earning now into protecting and developing the capital for the future when they'll no longer have that income. And so the capital will only continue growing more and more crowded. The Maldives is also currently a pretty young country, where the median age is only 32 years old and where the fertility rate only dropped beneath the 2.1 replacement rate in 2014. In the not-too-distant future, by 2054, the population of the Maldives is currently projected to nearly double from what it is today and surpass 1 million people. It's therefore possible that as the various trends that are pushing people out of the outer islands towards the capital continues to its ultimate conclusion near the end of the century, with most if not all of the outer islands destroyed, the world could experience a bizarre situation where nearly the entire population of the country by then, all nearly 1 million people, will be living on the utterly, absurdly crowded islands around Malay. And so Malay's current level of population density, which is already the highest in the world, will somehow, inconceivably, be even more insane than it already is today. An impossibly dense little speck of land trapped in the middle of a still rising ocean under siege. And once they're all crowded together there, up in their new high-rises and the outer islands are all dead beneath the waves, and the tourism industry dead and buried along with them, what will end up being left of Maldivian society by then? And what will end up happening to their economy and their standard of living without the cash cow of the tourism industry, left with zero resources other than dwindling fish stocks, nothing else left to export, and more crowded together than any civilization has ever been before in history, trapped in the middle of the ocean, hundreds of kilometers away from anybody else? I don't know the answers to those questions, and if there's any silver lining here, it is at least that the Maldivians have several more decades ahead of them to figure all of that out before it all starts to go into a very dark place. While there's a lot to be concerned about living in the Maldives, there's also a lot to be concerned about while living in the United States as well. You may not know this, but America has some of the weakest privacy and data protection laws anywhere in the developed world. Which means that relative to other countries, there's a ton of Americans' personal data that just gets put out into the public record, sometimes by federal, state, and city governments themselves. This has always been the case here, but it never really became a critical issue until the advent of the internet, when people began being able to make money by making it easier for other people to get a hold of your personal data. These people and the websites they create are known as data brokers. These are private companies that collect and then sell your personal data that they scrape from publicly available records like electoral rolls and census reports. And there are hundreds of these kinds of data broker companies probably selling your personal information right now. These companies could have your name, phone number, address, shopping habits, and possibly even your social security number that's all available to the highest bidder. I know that when I checked myself and typed in my own name, there were literally hundreds of different companies that had this kind of information up for sale to other companies, scammers, stalkers, or even worse. At best, this situation leads to frequent scam calls and spam emails, and at worst, it can lead to doxing, phishing attempts, or even identity theft. Data breaches are getting more and more common every year, and especially if you live in the United States, you straight up don't have any federal protection from these kinds of companies whatsoever. But this is where this video sponsor Incogni comes in to help. Incogni will fight on your behalf to remove your personal data from data brokers, and they'll deal with any objections that come from their side. All you've got to do is create an account and give them your approval to work on your behalf. Incogni will then carry out repeated ongoing removals, because even if the broker removes your data once, they can always just collect it and then sell it again. Incogni will repeatedly fight to make sure that your personal information stays off of the market permanently. I know that when I signed up, it was horrifying to see how many brokers out there had my data, and it was so satisfying seeing Incogni getting them deleted one by one. And I've seen a huge decrease in the number of spam calls and emails that I've gotten ever since. So if you'd like to give Incogni a try as well, you can do so by clicking the button that's here on your screen right now or by going to incogni.com/reallifelore, where you can use the code reallifelore to get 60% off of an annual Incogni plan. You'll also be greatly helping to support my channel at the same time. So once again, that's incogni.com/reallifelore and code reallifelore for 60% off of an annual Incogni plan. And as always, thank you so much for watching.